Have you witnessed a miracle? And was the miracle from God? I mean, we assume so when we use that term, don't we? But we also know that Satan has his ways, lying wonders, as God calls them. But when we just use the term miracles, yes, we are talking about God. But what actually is a miracle? We can see many examples in the scriptures and get our definition from that, of course. But a general definition of the word miracle means a marvelous event manifesting or making plain, making open, a supernatural act of a divine agent. A marvelous event manifesting a supernatural act of a divine agent. Or, said another way, a surprising and welcome event that is not explicable by natural or scientific laws. A surprising and welcome event that is not explicable by natural or scientific laws and is therefore considered to be the work of a divine agency. And this is words, man's words, mumbly jumble, where they don't want to use God's name, but nevertheless, that's who they're talking about. And we know that God has worked many miracles through his Holy Spirit, with only some of them being recorded in the scriptures. You recall that it said about Jesus Christ and his works that if they were all recorded, that there wouldn't be enough books to hold all that he did. And there was a lot of miraculous things that he did. But he's not the only one. There's a lot of other miracles that were recorded, and they involved various and sundry different peoples at different times. But when God created the physical universe, was that not a miracle? Was that not a marvelous event not explicable by natural or scientific laws? We think about, you know, if we happen to know how to cook, about creating a pie that looks like a pie, that smells like a pie, that tastes like a pie. That is a miraculous event for me. But for someone else, eh. But to create the entire physical cosmos that we see, that we call the universe, is that not a marvelous, inexplicable event? Do any of us know how to do that? Can any of us even begin to fathom what we would need to do to begin that process or to bring it about? No. So it certainly fits into that category. And you know, God at different times has given the gift of miracles to men, has he not? So do spectacular miracles have a purpose? God does them. God allows some men to do them. Do they have a purpose? Do spectacular miracles bring about other results than just the result of the miracle itself? Do other things happen because of that particular miracle? Well, today we will discuss the purpose of these, what I call public miracles, and the reasons for them, so that we will be able to have a little better understanding of the relationship of spectacular or public miracles to the role of the church now and in the future. So, what miracles are being done today? What does our thought go to just automatically? Healings. Am I right? That's probably the first thing that pops into our mind when we think about what miracles are actually being performed today. Well, healings certainly come to mind. And we all know of some pretty impressive healings, maybe to ourselves or maybe to someone we know, or just a story that we heard someone relate that it happened to them. And it was just mind-boggling when you heard how it happened or the circumstances under which it occurred. But remember that healing is only one type of miracle. You remember that Christ told the disciples that they would take up serpents without harm, meaning poisonous serpents, obviously. Non-poisonous ones, you don't really have to sweat. They're not going to hurt you, other than maybe some of you out there might be scared to death, but that's it. But he did say that his disciples would take up serpents without harm and by accident drink something deadly but with no ill effect, heal the sick, cast out demons. Now, these miracles that we're talking about here, even though they may raise our eyes a bit, our eyebrows, our interest, our excitement level, these miracles are mostly quiet and unobtrusive, and they are done according to God's command, mostly within the confines of the church. Generally, these miracles and healings are not spectacular public miracles. Now, God does give specific gifts to certain people. Let's turn over to a scripture we've all read many times, I'm sure. 1 Corinthians chapter 12. 1 Corinthians chapter 12, if I can find it here. 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and beginning verse 28. 1 Corinthians 12, verse 28 through 30. 1 Corinthians 12, verses 28 through 30. And God has appointed these in the church: first, apostles; second, prophets; third, teachers; after that, miracles; then, gifts of healings, helps, administration, varieties of tongues. So there's a certain order of things, the way God puts it. And you notice miracles are listed as miracles, healings as healings. Well, they're in the same category, but healings do not constitute all miracles. And all miracles do not constitute all healings. I mean, all healings are miracles, I should say, but you get what I'm saying. Verse 29, are all apostles, are all prophets, are all teachers, are all workers of miracles, do all have gifts, in verse 30, of healings? Do all speak with tongues? Do all interpret? So he's just making the point here that God gives these gifts as he knows best and according to his plan and purpose at that particular time in the church. But again, he gives these gifts, and because we are converted, we are in the church, we have God's Spirit, but does that mean that any of us, because of that, have, say, the gift of miracles or the gift of healing or the gift of tongues? No. Those are given as particular gifts in particular circumstances at particular times for particular reasons. So we always need to make that distinction. Now, Jesus said that no man born of a woman was greater than John the Baptist, didn't he? And he also said that John did no public miracles. So not all leaders in the church do public miracles or will do public miracles. Although many private healings take place in the church and demons are quietly cast out, this does bring up a question. While we know that many healings, that is, and their miracles, occur within the church, why are not all healed? Why are not all demons cast out? You know, you recall the disciples had that problem. Somebody needed a demon cast out, and they couldn't do it. Now, they cast out other demons, but this particular one they couldn't do. You remember that story. So you see, there's that going on, and we need to understand that. So does this mean that God is not pleased with his church, or that there's a lack of faith when public miracles do not occur? Is that what that means? You know, I remember somebody saying a long time ago, back in Worldwide, that this person didn't understand why the church wasn't having marvelous healings. Why wasn't the church having more healing? Why wasn't the church having more people who sought healing healed? He didn't get that. He didn't understand that. Now, it turns out he had other issues and problems going on, but the question was a valid one, but it's easily answered if you study this subject. Let's talk about Moses for a moment. We're going to look at some examples. Exodus chapter 7. Let's turn over to Exodus chapter 7. It's here somewhere. Exodus chapter 7, verses 8 through 12. Exodus chapter 7, verses 8 through 12. Exodus 7, verses 8 through 12. Then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, when Pharaoh speaks to you, now of course they were trying to get all of the Israelites out of Egypt. So when he says to you, show a miracle for yourselves, then you shall say to Aaron, now this is God speaking, you'll say to Aaron, because Aaron was his, you know, chief of staff, you might say. He was the spokesman of the two. Moses told him what to do. Aaron did it. He said, take your rod, cast it before Pharaoh, and let it become a serpent. So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did so. Just as the Lord commanded, and Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh, before his servants, and became a serpent. Verse 11, but Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers, so the magicians of Egypt. They also did in like manner with their enchantments. So here we have some counter miracles going on from another source. Verse 12, for every man threw down his rod and they became serpents. You know, that would have been a hair-raising event, standing there watching all that, wouldn't it? I don't think we're talking about little black snakes here. I think we're talking about pit vipers, you know, the ones that have poison dripping from their fangs. Dangerous fellas. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods. Talk about showing who's boss. Now, these were not low-key miracles. We're talking about the court of Pharaoh. We're talking about Egypt that was the preeminent power of its day, militarily, economically, in every way, in learning, in every way the Egyptians dominated the known world. At that time, they came, they went, as other nations did or other kingdoms did. But at that time, they had a lot of people coming in, going out from other nations. This stuff going on was not hidden in a corner. This was going out to other nations in the known world rapidly. If you don't believe me, just tell your neighbor something and see how long it takes for it to get around the whole area. Just a little something. We're talking about enchantments and snakes and power and might. This was an example of public miracles that got spread far and wide to other nations, not low-key ones. So Moses went on to perform other miracles, as we'll recall. Dividing the Red Sea, making bitter waters sweet, bringing water out of rocks in the desert, victory in battle. All of these were large public miracles. We think the desert, here's these 12 and a half Israelites are out now. Now, there was many more people, millions of Israelites out there. All these other kingdoms wanting to either take them over, loot them, or kill them all. This stuff was out there where many other nations knew what was going on with Israel as they traveled around. Because half the time they were knocking on doors as they went, looking for passage. So these were all public, very public, wide known miracles. However, Moses couldn't always do what he wanted to with miracles when he wanted. Well, imagine that. Was it a lack of faith? Was God just horribly displeased with the man? Numbers chapter 12. Let's take a look at Numbers chapter 12. Numbers chapter 12. And I'm not going to read all of this, but the story is in Numbers 12, beginning in verse 1 through 14. Numbers 12, 1 through 14. Now, this is where Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because he had married an Ethiopian woman. And Miriam and Aaron both felt that, well, God had revealed himself to them too. And they felt, well, who is this Moses doing something he shouldn't be doing when God has dealt with us also? Well, unfortunately, they they didn't just hold that thought. They let it get out. And that's when God said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting. And they did. Verse 5, the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam. Now, that's interesting. Any other time, God would call Moses of those three. So you have to think that in the back of their mind, they thought, oh, I'm going to get a cupcake? Is this going to be good? But they went forward. Then he said, hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. But not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak to him face to face. Now, by that time, they knew what was going on because he didn't speak to them that way, not to Miriam and Aaron. So the anger of the Lord, verse 9, was aroused against them, and he departed. And the cloud departed above the tabernacle. And then suddenly, Miriam became leprous, as white as snow. Leprosy, instant. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. Aaron said to Moses, my Lord, please don't lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly, in which we have sinned. Don't let her be as one dead, which... yeah, leprosy made you look that way whether you were or not. So Moses cried out. Now here's Moses. I'm sure he was appalled. I mean, his sister, you know, no matter what she was thinking or did at the moment back when she shouldn't have, but still. He cried out to the Lord saying, please heal her, O God, I pray. Now, don't you think that Moses wanted her healed right then and there? Sure. He didn't want her to not be healed. I can just see God saying to Moses, you know, if her father had but just spit in her face, would she not have been at least shamed 7 days? Like Moses. Come on. She needs to pay attention here. She needs to learn a lesson. So God said, let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterwards she may be received again, meaning she would be healed, she would be whole, she could get back into the camp. It'd be over with. But although Moses wanted her healed at once, as did Aaron, God required a 7-day period of trial before allowing her to be healed. God's wisdom and purpose, and this is the point, God's wisdom and purpose affected Moses' ability to perform miracles. He was a man given the gift of miracles. But always remember that God's wisdom and purpose affects the ability to perform those. How about Elijah? Quite a miracle-making guy, wasn't he? A prophet. A prophet of God, he was given the gift of miracles. You can read where Elijah did a lot of things. He stopped the rain and dew from falling on Israel for several years. You can read his story. He raised a widow's son from death. In other words, he resurrected physically a widow's son who had died. Elijah did that. He called down fire out of heaven to consume the offering and the altar itself in front of the prophets of Baal and Asherah. You remember that. It destroyed, it took everything, even the water that he had poured all over everything. It licked it up, as it says in the King James. He restored the rain to Israel later on, and the dew. He divided the waters of the Jordan. He burned up 102 men with fire. He called down fire from heaven in a sequence of events where several different men were sent to him trying to get him to do something from the king, as I recall. Altogether, there was 102 men that were burned up with fire from heaven that King Ahaziah sent after him. But this miracle worker ran into a problem, though, as we know, we recall. 1 Kings. Let's jump over to 1 Kings chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19, verses 1 through 4. 1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 4. And I believe we all remember the story. And Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all the prophets with the sword. He executed his prophets, and he executed her prophets. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah, saying, "So let the gods do to me, and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." And when he saw that, he called down fire out of heaven. No. And when he saw that message and read it and realized what she had said, he arose and ran for his life. Reminds me of a song. And out the window he ran. He didn't even wait for the door. He took the nearest opening and took off. He went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. Running for his life he was, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die and said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my fathers. Despite all the things that's happened, all the things I've done, I'm going to die a dog's death here at the hands of Jezebel. Just take my life. It's going to happen." Why didn't he blast her with a particle beam or something from the orbiting mothership or whatever he could do? Why didn't he? I'm sure he would like to have accomplished a miracle at that moment, at that time when he heard that from Jezebel. Maybe brought down fire on her to consume her and end the problem. Wouldn't that have been the logical thing that you're thinking about? 102 guys, you just turn to smoke and vapor? But he couldn't do that because God used this situation to reveal to Elijah several things about himself. Now, we're not reading that whole story, but you recall when he was hiding in the cave and God says, "What are you doing?" But God used that opportunity to reveal to Elijah several things about himself. And the others that still worship God mentioned in the verses following the ones I read here about him. So again, we won't continue on with that story. I think most of you recall it. But God's purpose, his will, his purpose, affected Elijah's ability to perform miracles. How about Paul? The Apostle Paul. There's a lot in the Bible about Paul, of course, and his events. So we won't read that much about him, but we'll talk about it a little bit. You recall the situation, he was on the Isle of Paphos, and a false prophet called Elimas, or Bar-Jesus, as he was called elsewhere. He was kind of like the advisor to the proconsul there, the Roman proconsul, Sergius Paulus. But he recognized a threat to his inroad to the proconsul. He didn't want Paul diverting his authority that he gained, his prestige, his power, by confusing the proconsul with, you know, the truth, with the word of God. So through a public miracle, Paul caused the false prophet to lose his vision. He just told him, he says, boom, it's going to happen. You're going to lose your vision for several days. And the veil came over that guy's eyes and he couldn't see anything. He had to be led around by the hand for days. He had no time to mess with Paul and Paul's interaction with the proconsul. This effectively stopped his efforts, you know, this false prophet. By the way, did you recall, he was a Jew. Not that that means anything, but I found that to be ironic in a way. This false prophet. And of course it showed very quickly, simply, that God's way was certainly backed by ultimate authority and power. And this fellow, who you know had a high standing with the people, he was important. He could do stuff. You know, he was a sorcerer. He was a whatever. But God's power was quickly shown to trump Satan's at any situation, any given moment. And that through a very public miracle. Again, you're talking about a seat of government. You're talking about people being aware of this, the guy's staff, all these people around, they knew what happened. You don't think it wasn't broadcast all around that island and to all the travelers and people coming and going from that island to other parts of the Roman Empire? You betcha it was. Public miracle, a very public one. In another example, remember that slave girl who followed Paul and his party around for days? And she had a spirit of divination. She had a demon. And all she would say is, these are servants of the Most High God who preach the way of salvation, or words to that effect. And that's what she did, day in, day out, following them around like a little dog, doing this to the point where Paul just couldn't take it anymore. And he cast that demon from her. Well, it sounded like a good deed, didn't it? Except we know that she brought her masters a lot of money in by all her fortune-telling. It's always the buck. Forget right, forget anything but the buck. So immediately, those masters became immediately upset, which meant the government became upset, which means that everybody became upset, nearly, with Paul. But that was a public miracle. It was all known around everywhere. This was a big deal, and the people involved, the people that owned this slave, the government who supported the owners of this slave, who backed him, everybody knew about it. Another public miracle that Paul did quickly, right to the point. You remember the time when Paul was speaking before he was heading off and leaving the brethren at this one point, and he talked and he talked and he talked and he talked and he spoke, and he kind of like I'm doing, and he talked, and this young lad up in the third story window of this building that he was doing this preaching at fell out of the window, hit the ground, boom, dead. I mean, fall out of a third story window and you'll know what I'm talking about. Most people, that's it. You die. That's what happened to him. And of course, Paul went down there, raised him from the dead. They brought him back up and gave him something to drink and fed him and all that. And Paul went on with what he needed to do, all in a day's work. But you don't think that wasn't a public miracle? You don't think that that miracle wasn't bandied about everywhere in the whole area, maybe all of Israel, Judah, whatever, that went out Sure it did. A public miracle. A very spectacular miracle. Some very happy parents and relatives that young man was alive once again. You don't think they didn't spread it around everywhere they went? You think the young man didn't spread it around everywhere he went? Now, he may not have realized what happened, but he heard enough to know what happened. However, things did not always go the way Paul would have liked, even with miracles. In Acts, we find Paul in a storm at sea. Again, it's a story I think you're all familiar with. Storm caught the ship up. Now, Paul told these fellows on the ship that God had told him that not one hair of their heads would be harmed, you know, if they just did what he said. And you know what? That storm went 14 days. Now, you're on this boat out in the middle of the ocean somewhere. Can you imagine 2 weeks you're in this storm where you can't steer the boat? You can't do anything that you normally do on a boat going from point A to point B, because that's the whole purpose of being on that boat in the first place. 14 days. After a while, you begin to wonder, are we all going to die? Why isn't this just stopped? You remember when Jesus Christ was on board the boat in the Sea of Galilee with his disciples? He was sleeping. Storm blew up, everything going crazy. The disciples are screaming, we're going to die, we're going to die. And he said, you know, where's your faith? And he instantly calmed the seas and the wind. Boom, just like that. There was no waiting around for it. It just there. Paul, who had done miracles himself through, of course, God's power, 14 days. And you know Paul wanted all of that craziness to stop. I mean, personally, that's what he wanted. He wanted to do God's will. But sometimes you don't know what exactly God's will is at that moment. Things are a little hectic. 14 days. Another time, picking up wood for the fire, and that pit viper, right on his hand, bit him. He just shook it off into the fire and went on. No ill effects, and everybody was looking at him like, he must be cursed of the gods. He's going to die. Of course, nothing happened, and they thought probably he was a god or something. But at the same time, Paul was apparently never healed of his thorn in the flesh. He asked God to heal him 3 specific times. And each time God says, my grace is sufficient for you. And he did not heal him. As far as we know, he was never healed of that. Why? Was there a lack of faith somewhere? Was God just horribly displeased with Paul? No, like all these others, and the others that you may read in the scriptures, God's purpose affected Paul's ability to perform miracles. He may give the gift of miracles, but it's just not always carte blanche whenever you feel like it. All of these men and others learned that. So it's evident from all these examples, just the few that I've covered here, and there are many others that we haven't covered, that chosen men of God worked miracles, didn't they? Time after time, but sometimes they could not. They could not do a miracle that you know they probably had in mind they would like to have done. But they couldn't because God's will dictated otherwise. In other words, God's plan at that particular point, that particular time, dictated whether he allowed public miracles to occur or not. Now, the result of all of this is that since the church was founded in 31 AD, well, I'll just ask, what is the result of public miracles as shown in the scriptures? We know there's been plenty of them. Because public miracles result, don't they, in a large audience, a much larger audience than what we're used to, hearing God's truth preached. But sooner or later, usually sooner, strong persecution of God's people and the church sets in, does it not? And you recall about the diaspora, the dispersion of the New Testament church, scattered. And why was that? Persecution. Why was that? Because of, in part at least, a very large part, because of the tremendous public miracles, both of preaching the gospel and the works and wonders that were being done. We'll talk a little bit more about that as we go on. But we do have some examples of just this thing here in the scriptures. You remember Peter and John healed a man who was unable to walk. And the people, they were amazed at this great public miracle, because where it happened, I mean, Jerusalem, the place was chock full of people. Not just Jews, but a lot of other people. But because of this spectacular miracle, this caused a great stirring of the people. And then the officials, of course, always watching out for themselves, they took Peter and John into custody or friendly, come visit us. Let's turn to Acts chapter 4. Acts chapter 4, and we'll hit a few scriptures here. Acts chapter 4, we'll begin in verse 7. Acts chapter 4, in verse 7. So these same officials, when they had set them in the midst, they asked, "By what power or by what name have you done this?" Now there's a dialogue, there's a going back and forth, and, you know, they're explaining, and these officials are denigrating, you know, the apostles. They're denigrating the guy who was healed. You know, they're just denigrating his parents. They're denigrating everybody because they didn't want it to be so. They didn't want this to actually have be what it was. Verse 14, but after all of that, and seeing the man who had been healed. Now, this man had been this way from birth. This was no thing that somebody come along and acted like they were this way for a little period of time and then, oh, I'm healed. No, he was this way from birth and everybody knew it. Everyone knew it. They saw him standing there healed and they could say nothing against it. I mean, ultimately, it came down to the fact that they couldn't deny that he was standing there walking around when all his life he couldn't do that at all. Verse 16. They're talking amongst themselves and saying, "What shall we do to these men? For indeed that a notable miracle has been done through them is evident to all who dwell in Jerusalem, and we cannot deny it." A notable miracle or remarkable sign brought attention from the people. And then consternation and jealousy from the leaders, because anything that pulls anything away from them means they're going to be standing there with less later on, whether it's authority, money, position. We know how that works. We have a whole country full of it, don't we? So that resulted then in persecution for God's people. Now, we do remember, of course, that God's people, or rather the apostles, did many signs and many wonders. Acts chapter 5, just flip over a page. Acts chapter 5, verses 12 through 18. Acts chapter 5, verses 12 through 18. Acts 5, verses 12 through 18. And through the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were done among the people, and they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch, yet none of the rest dared join them, but the people esteemed them highly. The people wanted to see more of this. You know, remember when Christ fed the 5,000 and all of that? That's what the people wanted. They wanted something special, something spectacular. They did many signs, many wonders, and it doesn't even describe them in the scriptures. But they were so eye-catching that the people esteemed them highly. And believers were increasingly added to the Lord. So out of this mass of unconverted people, those whom God was calling were being added to the church. Multitudes of both men and women. Verse 15, so that they brought the sick. This is a goodie. So they brought the sick into the streets and laid them on beds and couches, that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might fall on some of them. Why? Because if his shadow so much as even touched one of the sick, they were healed instantly. Now, if you knew, let's say you lived in Alabama, and you knew that in St. Louis there was a guy who, if you just walked close to him where his shadow touched you, you would be healed of X, Y, Z, whatever it is you have, ailments-wise. How fast would it take you to get to St. Louis? If you were in South America and heard about it and knew from Uncle so-and-so that lives in Jersey that saw it on the news and you knew it was true, how long would it take you to get from South America to St. Louis? Or from Russia to, or from anywhere in the world if you had the bucks to get on a plane? Or you could talk the U.S. government into paying your fare, as happens. People knew about this far and wide. They were bringing sick people from all over, anywhere that they could come from and get there on burrow, walking, boats, you name it. And if that wasn't a public miracle, it's one thing to lay hands on somebody and they're healed, and wow, that is unbelievable, almost, for unconverted people anyway. But for the shadow of someone to touch and they were healed, now you're getting down into pure entertainment here. There'd be a lot of people just wanting to get there to see all of this, and you know there were, besides all those who legitimately wanted to be healed. Also, a multitude gathered from the surrounding cities, this is verse 16, like it says, surrounding cities to Jerusalem. And I would say some of those surrounding cities weren't even in Judah. I mean, this is, the word was going out. Bringing sick people and those who were tormented by unclean spirits, and they were all healed. Every one. So aside from the healings, which is unbelievably wonderful, aside from those, though, what was the result of these widely known public miracles? Verse 17. Then the high priest rose up, and all those who were with him, which is the sect of the Sadducees, and they were filled with indignation. Well, how dare these peasants be healed? You know, how dare they come from who knows where, Britain or somewhere, just got off a boat. How dare they? Indignation, jealousy. It wasn't so much him publicly feeling that way. He didn't care if they were healed or not, frankly. But we all know that they felt threatened. Here was a power that the high priest couldn't control. He couldn't do. He couldn't censor. The government which backed him, which supported him, which kept him there, they couldn't do anything either like that. All of a sudden, everybody starts seeing their jobs evaporating, their prestige, their influence going out the window. They were filled with jealousy, in verse 18, and laid their hands on the apostles and put them in the common prison. So that was their payment. That was their reward. You wonder where that expression comes from about doing good and the reward for it. Well, probably came from this or something similar. But the result was persecution of God's people and the work. The two don't seem to be, it doesn't make sense to the converted mind. But it does to the people who have the reins of power. Now, Stephen is another guy. We know he did many public miracles. Another page over, Acts 6 and verse 8. Acts chapter 6 and verse 8. And Stephen, full of faith and power, did great wonders and signs among the people. Public, great works, signs. The result was the persecution of the way, the death of Stephen, a worker of miracles, but they killed him. The rulers were intimidated by those miracles which swayed the hearts of the people away from them. Prior to this, they just looked to whoever was in charge as though, help us, you know, do something for us. Now they had somebody who could do things these civil servants couldn't do on their best day, let alone their worst. They were intimidated by his miracles, which swayed the hearts of the people away from them. And the gospel itself cut them, as it says in another place about another group of people, it cut them to the quick. It opened up light on a dark place in their hearts and minds. Now we know Paul, going back to Paul, amongst other things he did, he healed people. He healed someone publicly, and then he preached the gospel strongly, and look what happened. Again, we're familiar, but let's look at this. Acts chapter 14, a few pages over. Acts chapter 14, verses 8 through 19. Again, I'm not going to read it all. Acts 14, verses 8 through 19. Talking about Lystra, a certain man without strength in his feet was sitting, a cripple from his mother's womb. He had never walked. So he heard Paul, and Paul observed him intently, it says, seeing he had the faith to be healed. He saw that this man wanted healing and said with a loud voice, stand up straight on your feet. And he leaped and walked. And what did these people do? They said in the voice of the Lyconian language, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. Now these were all, you know, pagans, unconverted people totally. All of a sudden they saw this happen. Well, the gods did this. And they called Barnabas Zeus and Paul Hermes. And, you know, things were getting out of hand quick. Priest of Zeus, what did he do? Temple was in front of their city. He brought oxen and stuff to the gates. And he was going to sacrifice to the multitudes. But then the apostles, you know, heard that. And, of course, they said, no, we're men. We're men like you. We preach that you should turn from these useless things to the living God, verse 15, who made the heaven, who made the earth, the sea, and all things that's in them, who in bygone generations allowed all nations to walk in their own ways. Nevertheless, he did not leave himself without witness in that he did good, gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons, filling our hearts and food with gladness. And even saying these things, I could hardly constrain the people from sacrificing to them. So then those Jews feeling threatened, stirred up the people, told them a pack of lies, got them going the other way, and the same people who called them gods, who were going to sacrifice oxen to them on their behalf, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing him to be dead. So Paul healed someone and was worshipped as a god by unconverted people, yet those same people, whipped up by the establishment, let's say, stoned Paul, leaving him for dead. Now, if that isn't a whiplash situation. So public miracles capture the imagination of the unconverted, which is followed by attacks from those in power because, sensing the display and the teaching behind the miracles as a challenge to their authority, to their way of life, to their checkbook, to their cushy existence. And it doesn't matter whether we're talking about religious or civil authority or both. Physical violence, trauma, and persecution follow public miracles when it involves a government other than God's government. Every instance you want to look at, it's in there. It's the same story over and over and over. So what are some of the purposes then of public miracles? We can see the results, the overall result, aside from the miracle itself, it brings on something not as pleasant for God's people. But the purposes of public miracles, and there are several, public miracles, number one, bring public awareness of the church and even the soon coming kingdom of God, because that is part of the message, part of the gospel. And spectacular miracles provide a strong witness to the unconverted public. Now, Moses did miracles to show Egypt and Israel who the true God was and is, and that he is supreme. That's what he was doing. But those miracles were for unconverted people. That's who they were directed to and the reasons why. And miracles, and many of them, were done by those in the New Testament church. And they showed the Jews and those in authority specifically that God had placed his authority in his church with his apostles. Again, that message went to the unconverted, or that understanding, let's say, by those public miracles. And we know in the future God will unleash miraculous plagues during the day of the Lord, don't we? On unconverted people of the world to get their attention too. And of course they have no idea about the true God, the purpose of life, his plan, no idea at all. Now the ability, going back to one of those things that was mentioned in that list in Acts early on, ability to speak foreign languages or speaking in tongues is a miracle. And as it occurred in Jerusalem in 31 AD, a far-ranging, spectacular miracle. But it was primarily for the unconverted. You remember that Peter was giving a sermon before the church actually started, and others of the apostles were speaking at different times too. And what did it say? It said that they spoke, well, let's say that, I'm just throwing things out here. Let's say Peter spoke in Aramaic, and he was speaking in Aramaic. Or maybe he decided that with this power, he could just speak in Greek. Maybe he didn't know Greek. Maybe he did. I don't know. Let's just say he started speaking in Greek. Well, the people out there that spoke Greek, that was fine. Well, what about the people from Ethiopia or somewhere else that spoke other things, or Carthage or wherever they came from? Well, you recall, they heard the apostles speak in their language. They weren't necessarily speaking their language, but they heard it in their language. So we're talking about public miracles at that time, even just in the speaking, just in the tongues or the languages. But let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 14, because there's a point to what I'm saying here about languages even. But it's a miracle, and these same principles apply no matter what. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 22. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 22. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 22. Therefore, tongues are for a sign. Languages are for a sign, not to those who believe, but to unbelievers. Now, it's not just because it's a language. It's because it's a miracle. But prophesying is not for unbelievers, but for those who believe. So that is a message from God directly from a prophet to his people. That is directed to believers. But speaking in other languages is a public miracle that gathers great audience attention. as it did even in Jerusalem in 31 AD. And it's for a sign, like it says here, not to those who believe, but to unbelievers. So grand miracles are for those who do not believe, who don't even know they don't believe. They just simply are unaware, but they still don't believe. So this is one reason why we do not have to have spectacular public miracles in the church. Their attention and purpose truly is not for believers. The world of unbelievers has to have something, let's face it, explosive, fantastic, to catch people's attention. You know, there's a lot of stuff in life, and every day we're covered up with it. Something that really grabs their attention. A spectacular public miracle does exactly that. So that's one reason. Another reason, or purpose, is as the persecution shut down the phenomenal growth of the first century church, so will future grand, majestic public miracles draw the attention of the world. And the following persecution will shut down the present work, whenever that is, whatever form the work is taking at that particular moment. And it will necessitate the church being taken to a place of safety. Revelation 12:6, yes. Then the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So that's one of the purposes, frankly, of public miracles. It's to bring about and further and move along God's plan. Believe it or not, that's the way it's designed. That's the way it's happened down through time. Now, the third purpose I have, the last one. Now, we as individuals, if we had the power to part seas, in other words, you were given, whoever you are, you were given the power of miracles by God. So you had the power to part seas, to heal all manner of diseases at any time, to cause ourselves even to prosper at will, for things to go smooth, for things to go wonderfully, for people to be happy and content, safe, productive, leading meaningful lives. How much incentive do you think we would actually have if that went on that way to develop the character to obey God? If we could basically eradicate much of the misery or the pain or the difficulty that we face in this life, how long could we continue to do that and yet feel that God was a necessity in our life? I think I've used this example before in speaking sometime in the past. I don't remember what I was getting at the time. But if you had the power to walk through a hospital and just empty it, everybody would run out perfectly healed and whole, and into the next place and into the nursing home and wherever. And you could do that with your friends and your family, and you could have unlimited oil coming out of a big jar, expensive oil that you could sell for a huge profit. You could do all of these things as has been talked about in the scriptures. Really, how dependent would we be on God? I think our dependence would wane very quickly in our minds. I mean, it would. We'd pay lip service for a good while, but ultimately, that's why it goes on to say this in Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 through 8. Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 through 8. This is talking about Jesus Christ. Hebrews chapter 5, verses 7 through 8. Who in the days of his flesh when he had offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death and was heard because of his godly fear, though he was a son, yet he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. We learn obedience, we learn respect and honor toward our father and our elder brother and God's plan. Just like Jesus Christ learned these things as a human being. It wasn't that he didn't know them before. He did. But he had not experienced them as a human being until he was born one here on this earth. And he learned obedience by the things which he suffered. If we weren't suffering because we could just work a miracle anytime we wanted to, we wouldn't be learning much about obedience at all. We learn the same way Christ did. So if we could remove all those trials and problems, we wouldn't learn very well to obey God. And this is what Christ meant when he said we would be persecuted as he was. It's good for us, though it's difficult. So when will public miracles occur? Probably that question has come across your mind while I've been talking. You know, simply as God did in the past, he will do in the future. He told Moses and all the others when they were to perform mighty miracles. In other words, he allowed them or he didn't, depending, to further his plan at that time. And he'll do the same thing in the future. We won't turn there for time, but Revelation chapter 11, verses 3 through 6, just note it if you like. He's talking about giving power to his two witnesses. They'll prophesy. If anyone tries to harm them, fire will proceed from them, burn up those who would harm them. The power to shut up heaven, no rains. Power over waters, to turn them to blood, to strike the earth with all plagues as often as they desire. So God, sometime in the future, is going to give that type of power to the two witnesses. But one day, for the two witnesses, after a bit of time goes by, all of a sudden, they're not doing miracles, and they are murdered in the streets of Jerusalem. Of course, they're resurrected 3 days later, to the consternation of everybody. But even they will be allowed to do what they're doing until for God's purpose. So, to finish this up here, to conclude, God does cause certain ones to have the gift of miracles according to his will, according to his wisdom, his purpose, and he determines when those miracles will be done and when they won't, and it's all based upon God's great plan and purpose at that time. Now, he'll tell his people in the future, just like he had in the past, when and whom will actually do this, and when they'll do it, and for how long they'll do it. Keep in mind, the result of public miracles is widespread recognition of God's work and his power, obviously, and then widespread persecution of his people and his work from Satan and the world's governments, the world's backlash against authority that they want and that they do not have. But the purpose, several of those purposes of public miracles, does and is to provide a strong witness to the unconverted, bring about the conclusion in the world as we know it. We know that public miracles are for the unconverted. So, right now, we're dealing with life, aren't we? We're reading about these miracles in the scriptures, and we do know some smaller, more quiet miracles that occur, mostly in the church. But yet, we have to have the character to deal with the result of public miracles later when those occur, should those of us who are living at that time before Christ's return.